This is Laura Calkins of the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, continuing the oral history interview with Dr. Herbert Chandler. Today's date is the 8th of June, 2005. I am on the campus of Texas Tech in the Special Collections Building, and Dr. Chandler is speaking with me by telephone from Virginia. Good afternoon, sir.
Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you, and I've looked forward to resuming our talk, as I'm sure you know.
Okay. In
January 1967, Herb, you went back to Washington.
Around December 66, but I didn't get any work done until 67.
Okay. Did you have a home in the Washington area?
Oh, no. I ran an apartment.
Okay, just an apartment. And tell me about the position that you took at the Pentagon.
Okay, I was in the Plans and Policy Directorate of the Chief of Staff for Military Operations, and I had the Vietnam desk.
You were the principal officer on the desk.
That's right.
And how many people did you have working with you?
With me, I had about four or five.
Okay.
Different areas of the world.
Just to confirm, your rank at this time was major. Is that accurate?
I was a captain. I think I got promoted to major just as soon as I got back.
Okay. Well, that was a good thing.
Yeah.
Herb, let me ask you to clarify the position of the Strategic Plans and Policy Directorate within the Pentagon. Can you kind of sketch out how it lay within the organization?
Yeah, well, we were on the Army staff, of course,
mm-hmm.
and we worked for the Deputy Chief of Staff for Military Operations, which was similar to a G3.
Mm-hmm.
It was three-star Lieutenant General Emley.
Is that E-M-L-E-E?
L-E-M-L-E-Y.
Okay.
L-E-Y.
L-E-Y, I think. Uh-huh.
Yeah, I think so.
Mm-hmm.
And we were in Strategic Plans and Policy Directorate, where we made up plans and policies for different Army units all over the world. And I had the Vietnam desk, which meant that I looked out for Army units in Vietnam.
And, Herb, this is obviously an extremely important juncture in the conflict itself, late 66, early 67. Can you recall for listeners your sense of how the conflict in Vietnam was developing at that time? We talked about your own experience on the ground, but more broadly, what was the picture?
Well, the picture was that we were sending more people over there
mm-hmm.
all the time, and every time General Westmoreland requested additional men, we'd find out how many Army people he wanted and how many we were able to send through the draft and through the training of draftees. So we were building up most of the time.
And, for example, how much of the burden was being borne by the United States, and how much by our other allies, including the South Vietnamese at that point?
Well, there was very little being borne by the other than the United States. We finally got the South Vietnamese to draft 18-year-olds. Up until then, they had not done that. So we were forcing, or at least encouraging, the Vietnamese to build up their forces while we build up our own.
And would the work of the U.S. Army in helping guide the South Vietnamese forces, would that have come under your purview as well?
Well, to some extent. I wrote papers for the Chief of Staff on how we should use land reform, and I wrote papers for him on, and we tried to get American advisors to get certain privileges that other American officers didn't have. For instance, we told anybody who volunteered for an advisory role they would serve 18 months instead of a year, and they would be guaranteed to go to a war college after they finished their tour.
And that was a new development?
That was a new development, yeah.
And what was the thinking behind it?
The thinking behind it was that we had to encourage advisors so that we could make the Vietnamese more efficient by using more American advisors, by getting more people to volunteer.
So essentially this was a way to recruit people into the advising business,
yeah, to make advisory more important than being with the American Union. So everybody could see everybody wanted to be with an American Union, get its combat badges and so on. We wanted more advisors, or General Johnson, the chief of staff of the Army, wanted more advisors to help the Vietnamese become more efficient.
Did you work with General Johnson directly?
Yeah.
Can you? Well, I get that you would have been under him to some
degree.
Well,
within the chain of command, there was I worked for General Lemley directly, and he worked for General Johnson, so it worked out the same way.
Herb, can you tell me first of all about General Lemley? Can you give me a sketch of his, anything you know about his background, and then what he was like to work for?
Well, he was the commander at Fort Leavenworth before he became Death Ops, and he was an easy man to work for because he was listening to what General Johnson said, and he worked for General Johnson, and so did we. And whenever there was a paper that was going to the joint staff that General Johnson had to defend that afternoon, we would have a conference, and I would be on the head of the table if I was responsible for that paper, and General Johnson would be on my left, and General Lemley would be on my right, and all the other generals who had looked at the paper or had an interest in it were on down the line. And when General Johnson said, "Why did you put that in the paper?" you couldn't say, "Well, that dumbass brigadier general down there told me to do it." He had to defend it.
Right. Was it almost like a debating session?
Yeah, it was with General Johnson. Because he gave me one paper to write. Our consul general in Hong Kong had written to say that, had sent a telegram to say that our bombing was not productive and that was pissing other people off. Other countries. And General Johnson gave me the task of replying to that, so I replied to it, and then I added a paragraph in there that said, "Well, in actuality, he's right." And and so General Johnson said, "Well, let's debate that," and pushed back from the table, and we debated it for a while, and he accepted it, but he was the man you could do that with.
Interesting. Herb, how much discussion, if you remember, how much of the discussion, either that day or in general during the year that you were in this position, concerned China?
Very little.
Is that right?
Yeah. Now, that wasn't my purview, and I didn't know much about it. So we just talked about American forces in Vietnam.
Okay.
And how to make them more efficient, how to make the Vietnamese more efficient.
And were you also concerned with the, did you have any brief for dealing with casualties as well? How many American troops were being lost through?
Not very much, no.
Okay. Who would be dealing with that? Were in plans, I know.
I don't know. Probably the G1.
Okay. What kinds of efficiencies were you hoping to achieve? What kind of goals did you have in mind?
Well, to make the Vietnamese Army more efficient. To make the Vietnamese government more efficient. I wrote a paper on land reform in South Vietnam and advisors, how to make them more efficient, make their jobs more desirable. Those are the two things I remember most.
Okay. On the land reform question, can you remember much about the kinds of arguments that you would have put forward?
Well, yeah, we wanted to give land to the tillers. That became the official policy. The people who are tilling the land as sharecroppers should own it. And that's sort of the gist of the paper.
Okay.
That they should, that the Viet Cong would come in and give people the land they were tilling, and then they'd get thrown out, and the Vietnamese would collect back taxes and back rents from their from the peasants, and that didn't please the peasants very much.
Right, and so their political loyalties were at risk.
Yeah, exactly.
If not more.
Yeah, so we were trying to build up the government and build up the ARVN at the same time.
And who were you in communication with in Vietnam itself? Did you have an open line?
A counterpart? No, I did not.
Okay.
I did not. I called a couple of times, but I just really don't remember who.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask about the tools, the analytical tools that you would be using in this position. When you're writing papers on land reform or other issues like that, what information sources did you have?
Well, we had what was going on there before when mm-hmm. I was in the Ministry of Revolutionary Development.
Okay.
And basically just my knowledge of Vietnam and what was going on there.
Okay.
I don't really remember any specific references.
Were you getting... Go ahead, Herb.
One good thing for being where I was is that I knew the organization in Vietnam that we had recommended, the courts
mm-hmm.
operation was being implemented, and I was the one that explained that to General Johnson very easily because I was involved in it.
Did you ever have occasion during this year to meet with anyone from the National Security Council?
Not that year, no.
Okay. So your reporting was basically going up the chain inside the Army structure.
That's right.
Okay. And did you feel that you had kind of an open door to put forward the ideas that you wanted to express?
Absolutely. General Johnson wanted to hear anything, and he called upon me to do certain things like land reform. He had somebody from the Civil Affairs section write it, and he didn't like it, and he sent it over to me, and he liked mine better. So, yeah, I had an open door. I remember one time the University of Minnesota was going to have a series of broadcasts with prominent people. They were going to have General Johnson talk to people about why do we have a draft and why are we in Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
and he was going to be with Comer on that,
mm-hmm.
and so we rehearsed it one Saturday in the Pentagon, and I guess General Johnson was kind of nonplussed when I argued with him because I was supposed to represent Comer, and then he changed it and said, well, let's just have this as an afternoon in the Pentagon with some of my staff officers and have me, and they changed the introduction and I argued with him.
You argued with him?
Yeah, well, that was my role.
Well, that's right. And
they published that, and they said, you know, let that go out. Changed the heading to be afternoon chat with one of my officers.
Let me probe a little bit about the manpower problems. How much consideration were you giving to continued escalation? I mean, were there plans afoot already in 1967 for the kinds of escalations that the United States actually put into play later?
Well, we were going, 1967, we were doing it. We were escalating, and that was more of the G1, how many people we could send over.
Mm-hmm.
That was really the only thing that they were looking at. Now, we were more of a policy nature. What should we do with these men? What should we do with the advisors with the land reform and so on?
Mm-hmm.
We didn't get into how many men do we need or should we have.
Okay. Did you then discuss things like what percentage of the military force that we have over there should be devoted to pacification operations?
Well, no. I did that when I was in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
We recommended 50%, but when we got back to the Pentagon, now that wasn't my area.
Okay. How effective do you think you were in pushing for the ideas that you had been tasked with explaining?
Well, I think I was pretty effective because General Johnson was a person who would listen and who would take into account the things you said,
mm-hmm.
and especially in the organization role because I was involved in that in Vietnam and also was involved with it when I talked to him. I could explain it to him while we were doing it.
Did you ever attend briefings with senior officers from the other branches where General Johnson was speaking with them?
Well, yeah, down every time he had a paper that was going to the Joint Staff. As I said, General Johnson would be on the left, General Lamley would be on the right, and all the other generals would be spread out on the table.
Okay, from the other branches.
Yeah, and mm-hmm. I'd be at the head of the table. And we had coordinated with all these other people, of course.
Right. How long did you stay in this position?
About a year.
Okay. And were you happy to move on, or?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay. Tell me about where your next assignment took you.
My next assignment took me upstairs in the Pentagon to the office of the Assistant Secretary of Defense mm-hmm. for International Security Affairs. And I was in the policy planning staff, and I was the assistant for Southeast Asia. So assistant for Southeast Asia and the policy planning staff of the Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs.
Now, this is somewhat different organizationally, isn't it? Because now you're reporting directly to a civilian.
Right, to the Assistant Secretary, right.
Okay. And who was the Assistant Secretary?
Assistant Secretary Paul Warnke was.
Okay.
Because, on the 1st of March, I went up there on the 1st of January.
Mm-hmm.
On the 1st of March, McNamara was replaced by Clark Clifford.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know who was the Assistant Secretary of Defense before that, but Paul Warnke came in on the 1st of March.
Okay.
And Mort Halperin was the Deputy Assistant Secretary for the Policy Planning Staff.
Can you tell me a little bit about Paul Warnke? What was your impression of him?
Oh, yeah, he was a very nice
mm-hmm.
man. He would listen, and he would learn from his people. I didn't have my association with him. I associated mostly with Mort Halperin, who was the Deputy Assistant Secretary, and with Les Skelp, who was the head of the policy planning staff.
Tell me, then, your impressions of Mort Halperin.
Well, he was a very bright guy. He was a young fellow who had written a couple of books at Harvard,
mm-hmm.
and I had known him up there vaguely, and he was a smart guy, and you could talk to him. Les Skelp was also a real smart guy. He was a protege of Halperin's, I guess,
mm-hmm.
and you could talk to him very easily.
Now, Herb, of course, this time period when you first began in the Southeast Asian Affairs Office was the one that included the Tet period.
Tet offensive started in January, right?
Yeah. Can you tell me what impact it had on your work?
Well, sure. First thing that happened was that General Westmoreland asked for, and General Wheeler asked for 208,000 men, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had to evaluate that. Clark Clifford said he wanted an A to Z reassessment. And we gave him an A to Z reassessment. We asked everybody what they thought of it. I thought it was a terrible idea. We weren't going to get 208,000 men.
You thought it was a bad idea?
Yeah.
And can you say why or what you argued then?
Because we didn't have 208,000 men. Most of it was going to Europe in any case. And we just didn't have the people, and the war wasn't that important. The objectives weren't that important.
Did you argue that?
Yeah.
That the objectives...
We had 550,000 men, and that's all. We were going to have, I think they sent about 13,000 or 14,000 more over, but we didn't have them. So we wrote papers for the Assistant Secretary of Defense, Warnke, which we passed through Halperin and Galb. We said that was ridiculous. It wouldn't make any difference.
Really?
And Clark Clifford agreed with that.
And Herb, were you thinking about possible other engagements that the United States might have to?
Well, the Joint Staff was.
Mm-hmm. And so, with 500,000 men already in Vietnam.
Yeah, the most of the 208,000 were going to back up the Strategic Reserve. We're going to reconstitute the Strategic Reserve. They weren't going to Vietnam at all. And so we made that known,
mm-hmm.
and we also made known that we didn't have 208,000. And Lyndon Johnson, well, he wasn't president. Yeah, he was president at the time, 1968. He wasn't going to be a wartime president. He wasn't going to send that many men over. And Clark Clifford was more of a dove. He wanted to know how much difference it would make, and his Joint Staff notified him it wasn't going to make any difference. We were going to pursue the war just the same way we did. the Vietnamese, North Vietnamese would send down 200 or 1,000, and we'd still have a stalemate.
And so the thinking was that the North Vietnamese could match that increase.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so Clark Clifford was the new Secretary of Defense, and he couldn't get any answers from the Joint Staff, so he looked to us, and we said there were no answers. We should send about 30,000 more over and negotiate.
And when President Johnson announced later in the month, that
31st of March,
that's
yeah.
right, that he was not going to run again, what did you think about the future of the war? How did that make you feel? Do you remember?
Well, he said that he wasn't going to run again. He was going to send 20,000 men, and Clifford interpreted that to mean that that was the limit. No more Americans were going, and we were going to negotiate an ending to the war. The Vietnamese came back on the 4th of April saying they would not negotiate, but the only thing they would negotiate was the stopping of the bombing and all other acts of war against North Vietnam. Then we could get into substantive.
Mm-hmm.
And so we negotiated that, and I was a member of a National Security Council group. We had some people from the Joint Staff, from the CIA. It was led by Bill Bundy. I represented DOD because Morris Halperin didn't want to go, and Warnke didn't want to go.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were developing negotiating positions for the U.S. during the remainder of 68.
And so that work for you started in the late spring?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, in April, the early spring.
April, okay. And can you tell me about some of the early thinking in those meetings?
Well, the earliest thinking was that we would have a withdrawal of U.S. forces and North Vietnamese forces from South Vietnam. That was our thinking. And that we would stop the bombing if the North Vietnamese stopped attacking South Vietnamese cities. And so we sent all these forward, and it was a lot of coordination with all the State Department and the Joint Staff and the CIA to get these things done. We would argue over every word, really.
Every word?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Who was the State Department point person for this?
Oh, Bill Bundy, the Assistant Secretary. He was the chairman of each of the meetings. There were also a bunch of other people in there. Hayward Isham from the State Department, and he's the only one I can remember.
Was there anyone from AID, or were they represented by state?
No, they were. Well, they weren't involved.
They weren't important enough in this. Okay. And you mentioned the CIA. Was there a point person there?
Yeah, George Carper, who was deputy director of the CIA.
Okay. And do you have a sense of what role Bill Colby was playing at this point?
I have no idea, no.
Okay. Did you ever meet Bill Colby?
Never did.
No? Okay.
I met him at a conference at North Carolina University several years later.
Oh, okay. But not during the... Not at this
during
point.
The war.
Okay.
Yeah.
Were you also paying attention, Herb, to, in 1968, the political developments in the United States domestically?
Oh, yeah.
For example, that spring, in April 1968, Dr. King was shot. Do you remember anything about what happened in Washington when that occurred?
Well, I remember from the riots. I think I drove right through them. I was having lunch with someone, and I drove to 14th Street to get back to the Pentagon, and
mm-hmm.
seemed like there was a lot of fires and things burning, but it didn't affect me until I got home
mm-hmm.
that night and saw it on the news that I'd really come right on the fringes of it.
You were skirting around the edge.
Right.
Okay.
And it didn't affect the Pentagon very much.
Okay. Were there protesters out on the Pentagon steps in the morning when you would arrive?
Not that I remember, no.
No, you didn't. You never saw that?
No.
Okay. I know that it wouldn't have deterred you at all, but I just wonder if the sense of the growing protests in Washington...
Well, we knew that there were growing protests, but it didn't affect our thinking. We were thinking of the United States ought to get out of there in the first place.
And when you say we were thinking that, can you tell me who else...
Well, me and Les Galba and and Mort Halperin, I guess, and perhaps Warren Key and Clark Clifford themselves.
Mm-hmm. Did you meet with Secretary Clifford?
No, I don't think I ever did.
No? Okay. But certainly he was coming from that same
direction. Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. He was saying we've got to get our friend out of this because the Joint Staff had no plan to get out, and there was no, 208,000 men, what are we going to do with them? Well, their pile of bodies is going to get higher, and our pile of bodies is going to get higher.
You know, this couldn't have been a very easy position for him to be in.
That's right.
Going to the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
That's right. Read my book. I read
yes,
all
sir.
About it.
Yes, sir. can you tell a little bit for someone who might not have access to your book right away that what you saw in terms of the stresses that the secretary was under?
Well, he was under a great deal of stress because the president and the secretary of state wanted to go ahead, and he and the Joint Chiefs of Staff, of course, and he didn't want to go ahead. He thought we should negotiate and get our friend out of this, as he said. And so he was. There was hawks and doves within the administration, so-called, and he was a dove. And he was trying to get the president to modify his speech and instead of talking about war, talking about peace.
Mm-hmm.
And he was under a great deal of stress. He said he felt the president didn't like him anymore, that they had crossed paths and the president didn't like his style. But he finally prevailed. And we were lucky because the North Vietnamese on the 4th of February came back and said they wanted to negotiate.
Mm-hmm.
That was hard for us, too, because the president said, I will go anywhere to negotiate. And the North Vietnamese kept suggesting these places that weren't satisfactory.
Like?
Like Phnom Penh or like the Indonesian cruiser or Warsaw. So we finally held out for and got Paris, which is a much better venue.
And when was that decision actually arrived at?
Oh, I don't know, sometime in April.
Okay.
May of 68.
Uh-huh. And the plans that you were working on for negotiating positions, can you tell me anything more about those? Of course, we wanted the withdrawal of foreign troops.
Yeah, that basically was it. Withdrawal of foreign troops, return of prisoners of war,
mm-hmm.
things like that, negotiating positions that we would take.
How much pressure did you feel around the issue of American POWs?
I didn't feel very much, no. We were mainly getting our troops out of there and coming to peace, so I didn't feel much pressure of that at all.
What about the post-withdrawal preservation of South Vietnam? How important was that, Herb?
Well, that was very important. That's the objective we were fighting for.
Sure.
We were trying to make them more efficient and more effective. And it didn't seem like they were efficient or effective and would not survive long if we left. So they didn't want us to leave.
Mm-hmm. And you, of course, understanding that, had to develop plans that were best for the United States.
That's right.
Not best for South Vietnam.
That's right.
Were there any, was there any attempt, either through the State Department or through this planning group that you were on to, take the temperature of the South Vietnamese government?
Well, no. We felt it to be inefficient, and we would provide advisors, but the government wasn't the military's problem. Effectively, it was the State Department's problem, and they didn't say much about it.
Okay. So Bill Bundy was essentially sort of not putting that forward as a...
I remember one time Bill Bundy, he must have liked me because we were sitting in his office, and he was looking at me, and he's saying, we've got to do this, we've got to do that, and we've got to send the cable here. And I was nodding my head and thinking to myself, I hope you State Department types are taking notes because they're all your actions.
And I'm not responsible for any of that.
Yeah.
At this point in, say, the middle of 1968, with the new secretary in place, what, if you can remember, Herb, what were you thinking about the likely course of the war over the next couple of years? Did you think that your group would prevail?
I know. I thought that we would still be there and there'd be much of a stalemate.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, that's a bit, I mean, that must have been pretty discouraging.
Well, yeah, there was a war going on, and it was discouraging because we had no plan for winning the war, and they didn't either. And they couldn't with 500,000 American soldiers over there. So I was looking forward to getting out of the Pentagon and going to Vietnam and commanding a battalion, which was the next thing up the line that I should do.
And you knew that because of just career path planning?
That's right, yeah.
Okay. Let me ask, before we take you back to Vietnam, let me ask a little bit about broader Southeast Asian issues. How much concern did you have about the situations in Laos and Cambodia during this time period?
Well, very little, because there was nothing we could do about it. We weren't in Cambodia, and we were bombing the Ho Chi Minh Trail in Laos, I suppose.
Sure.
And those were the president's policies, so what we were considering was bombing North Vietnam, which was never very useful.
And did you ever think that you would see a time when U.S. troops would actually invade Cambodia?
No, not really. We had enough to do in Vietnam.
Well, you're right.
we couldn't handle that very well.
When still in 1968, what did you make of President Nixon's?
Oh, he didn't come until 69.
No, that's right. But as he was running for office over that summer, what did you make of his plans for the war? He was already talking, I think, about scaling back and Vietnamization and those kinds of things.
Yeah, well, Lyndon Johnson wouldn't scale back because he wouldn't withdraw troops because he didn't want to tie the hands of his successor, whether it be Humphrey or Nixon.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But he also wouldn't come to an agreement with the Vietnamese until the 30th of October, 4 or 5 days before the election. So he didn't help Humphrey any. And the South Vietnamese were opposed to any stopping of the bombing. In fact, the South Vietnamese, it seems, were in touch with Nixon's campaign and were trying to do everything they could to help Nixon.
Do you know anything more about that?
Well, only what my research has given, that the South Vietnamese were in touch with Nixon. A couple of his advisors, Madame Chinook. No, we didn't know anything about it in the Pentagon.
Okay.
And in the Pentagon, when Nixon came in, we were all suddenly, whether we were military officers or not, were suddenly not trusted.
And why do you say that?
Well, that brought new people in who didn't think that we were, according to their way of thinking, that they just didn't know who we were.
Was there an assumption, too, that you guys were all kind of tarred with the LBJ brush?
Yeah, to some extent there was. That was it, I guess. And we got a new assistant secretary and new deputy assistant secretaries.
So the timing for you was pretty good to actually kind of move out
of
there.
Yeah, move out about that.
Okay. How did it come about that you got the assignment back to Vietnam? Did you must have requested this.
I did, yeah.
And how did it happen? Can you tell me?
Well, they were looking for a battalion for me, and there was a battalion in the 101st, so I was assigned to the 101st.
And what was the location in South Vietnam?
Oh, we were in north South Vietnam, in Thua Thien province, which is the second province below, the first province below Quang Tri, which was the northernmost province.
Yes, and Quang Tri had for years been an extremely difficult place.
We were south of Quang Tri for, I was there for 10 months because I was selected to go to Air War College. And the first 4 months, I was the inspector general. And the last 6 months, I got my battalion, which was the 3rd Battalion of the 187th Infantry. And there were two battalions in the 101st that were involved in pacification operations that their provinces or their districts were pretty well pacified, and they were training Vietnamese, and I got one of those. 3rd 187th was in Phong Dien District along the street with Ao Choi.
And this is the third of the 187th was involved in the training primarily?
Right, yeah. Okay. We were a pacification battalion. There weren't very many VC in our area. There were a lot of Vietnamese refugees. And what we did was build a couple of roads and clear the vines and move the refugees from the refugee camp back to their little hamlets.
Did you have a full-strength battalion?
Oh, yeah, battalion, sure.
Okay. And as commander...
But also, let me tell you that we were the, in 1970, I was battalion commander, January 70 to June of 70. We were withdrawing by that time.
Yes.
And the only thing that had not been withdrawn was the 101st Airborne Division. And consequently, my men knew that we weren't trying to win and that they were there for a year. And their biggest issue was not to be the last man killed in Vietnam.
So how was morale then?
Well, the morale was good, but they weren't very aggressive.
Mm-hmm. And what did you do about that? What could you do about it?
Not very much. Mm-hmm. I tried to. Well, they all understood what they were doing was good and training the Vietnamese and all that. But we had some problems because the Vietnamese had nothing, of course. And my men were with them, and they had cameras and portable radios and all that sort of stuff. So we had some pilfering at first. But when our guys laid those things aside and tried to help them and move the refugees back to their hamlets, it worked out very well.
What about other disciplinary issues like, let's say, alcohol use or drug use? Is that
marijuana? No, I didn't have any of that.
You didn't have any of that.
I kept my troops out in the field, and it's divided up into small units, and so we didn't have much of that.
Do you remember anything about difficulties amongst the soldiers of different races?
No, we didn't have any of that.
None of that came to your attention? Yeah.
No, my executive officer was a African American, and everybody he commanded the rear, and everything was copacetic. No, we didn't have any problems.
What was his name, Herb?
Jake Watson.
How do you spell it? Do you know?
Watson. Okay. Jacob JCOB.
Mm-hmm. Was he an efficient officer or a good XO?
Oh yeah, well, he'd been my deputy when I was IG, so I took him along with me.
Okay, that was good for him then.
Oh yeah.
And you two worked together very well.
Very well.
Okay, what happened with the rest of his career? Do you know?
I have no idea. Never saw him since.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Huh. But he was a good officer for you.
Oh yeah. Well, I had my first S3, my first operations officer was John Hillen. And I devised this, we didn't have any VC that we could see except they were sneaking at night. So we had a rule that all the villagers would be in before dusk. And then our patrols would go out after dark. And in that period, the dusk to dark, that's when the VC would move around.
Right.
And so we had a bunch of eagle flights, I call them, with three helicopters, and I'd be in one, and then we'd have two helicopters full of troops, and we'd bounce around from place to place trying to find the VC. And we did. We found them quite often in little bunches of threes and fours. And we were going on an Eagle flight one night, and somebody tapped me on the shoulder and said, the brigade commander wants to see you. So I told my S3, John Hillen, to take the flight. And that's the flight that John Hillen got his femur broken, and one guy got killed. And
did they crash?
No, I don't think so. But they took John Hillen right to the aid station, and so I lost him.
That was a tough night.
Yeah, it should have been me, but it was John Hillen instead.
Yeah.
And so then that's when I brought Jake Watson up.
When you would locate a small group of VC on one of these Eagle flights, what action did you order?
Oh, my two helicopters with troops would go down and attack them.
From the air, like assault helicopters?
No, they'd come down and jump out of the air helicopters and go get them.
Wow. And you or the other commanding officer would stay airborne?
Above and tell them what's...
Okay, and watching the whole situation.
And bring some support in if they needed it.
Did you ever have to call in air support?
No, not on that.
No? Okay. So the concentrations of BC that you were seeing were very small.
Very small, just like the mafia operating in a big city.
Okay. Wow. Okay. And what about NVA in this area?
None.
Really?
We never saw any.
Yeah. And they were so then was your understanding and your intelligence that they were further north?
Yeah.
Up in Quang Tri?
They were in Quang Tri. We got a message one time that they were planning an attack in Quang Tri,
uh-huh.
and that we were the reinforcements. We were supposed to go up and help them, so I went up and met the battalion commander up there in Quang Tri and advised what his positions were and what I would do to help him, and they didn't attack, so we didn't have much to stay up there.
But you came close, sounds
yeah.
like.
Yeah, well, yeah, we were alerted for something to go on.
Now, this command of the 3rd 187th lasted for just the six-month period.
6 months, right.
Because you got another assignment?
Well, because I had been selected to go to the Air War College.
Yes.
And it started in August, I guess. So I had to leave in August instead of November.
Okay.
Or December.
And were you reluctant to leave Vietnam at that
oh,
point?
Oh, yeah.
Why?
My battalion was doing well.
Mm-hmm.
We were a fine battalion. We had good, confident leaders, and we had a good mission, and the troops enjoyed the mission and could see what they were doing. And it was a good battalion.
Now, did your guys give you a send-off?
Yeah, they did. We had a party.
They had a party for you?
Yeah.
Okay. So it sounds like they returned your affection.
Well, we had a lot of good time with them, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I had one platoon, and I always like to say this. Platoon was going through an area which they were supposed to clear, and a bomb went off, and the platoon sergeant and company commander got killed. And the rest of the platoon sat down and said, okay, that's it. We're not going to go anywhere. It's not worth it anymore. We throw us all in jail. We'd rather be there than in here.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had to go out and talk to them. And I talked to them, and I got them moving again. And
What can you remember what kinds of things you said?
Well,
because that's
told
a pretty
them,
tough situation.
I told them, you can't sit here all day, and you got to move and do something. And that's what happens in war and so on. I didn't threaten them. I didn't holler at them.
Mm-hmm.
But in the meantime, I brought another couple of platoons in on top of them. I appointed a new platoon sergeant who was the first sergeant for them. This was 1970.
Mm-hmm.
And moved them all out together. So it made them a small part of a bigger organization that was moving out. They moved out all right.
And that was one of your, I mean, was that kind of a design move? I mean, you...
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Sure was. Mm-hmm. I had to get them going.
Mm-hmm. And so both by persuasion and sort of carrot and stick a little
yeah,
bit.
Yeah, that's right.
Bringing in the other troops.
Yeah, the stick wasn't very useful.
Wasn't too heavy, sounds
yeah,
like.
That's right.
But as a commanding officer, of course, you know, this falls on your shoulders, whether this goes well or not.
That's right.
And I wonder if you can say something more about what it took kind of internally for you to, you know, get them moving.
I had to tell them that they weren't going to sit there. Threatening them didn't do any good because they didn't care.
Right, they were beyond that. Uh-huh.
Yeah. And so you had to make them part of a bigger. Oh, you had appointed leader that they respected, which was first sergeant,
mm-hmm.
and you had to get a lot of other men who would be the example for them.
Did you handpick the guy that you wanted to...
To be the platoon sergeant?
Yeah.
Yeah, oh, sure.
You already had him in mind?
Yeah, we didn't have very many NCOs at that time anyhow.
Right, because there was a shortage of those guys.
Yeah, well, there was a shortage because most of them were on their third tour.
Right, exactly, exactly.
And a lot of them had gotten killed, oh, yeah.
Yes. Do you remember the name of the guy?
That you selected? He was an old first sergeant with a mustache, and I had known him before. I don't remember his name.
But you'd already had a star next to his name as you could.
Well, I did that night. I didn't think I'd need it. I did need it.
Yeah, you did. You did. Yeah. Sounds like it. Well, and he got things moving and no more trouble after that?
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Well, let me ask you about the Air War College. You were attending as a student, essentially.
Yeah.
What was life like there?
life was very soft. You had classes in the morning, and then you played golf or handball in the afternoon. And you didn't have to study very much. It was pretty easy.
Now, is this down in Alabama?
In Maxwell Field, Alabama. Mm-hmm.
Let me ask about how much influence the ongoing conflict in Vietnam had on the curriculum.
I don't know. I wrote a paper about my experiences with the 187th.
Do we have a copy of that, sir?
I think
we probably do.
I think you do. Uh-huh. And there was I wrote an article in the December issue of Vietnam Magazine about it.
I saw that, actually.
Okay.
For somebody who wouldn't have access to that, though, can you just recount some of the points in the article? Some of the points you made?
Well, let me see the points. We were a pacification battalion, one of two in the 82nd, in the 101st Airborne,
mm-hmm.
and that we had moved the refugees back to their hamlets and villages. And I said the last, we taught the self-defense forces how to fend for themselves, and there were five hamlets, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And the last week I was there, the district chief asked me if he could borrow my helicopter, and I said, what for? And he said, well, D.C. tried to re-infiltrate these villages. They got three prisoners, three bodies. They got to get out of there. So they were beginning to take care of themselves. And that was very good. It was a real affirmation of our success.
Right, and that the efforts you put in were paying off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Now, at the Air War College, what kinds of things were you studying, you and the others, and how big was your class?
Well, I don't really know. We had 15 in seminar,
mm-hmm.
and I guess there were about 20 seminars, so that'd be about 300.
Okay.
And we studied, they had the class, the faculty from the Air Force Academy teach us about economics, and most of the rest of the time we studied U.S. Diplomacy overseas, U.S. We studied about NATO,
mm-hmm.
we studied about CETO, and that's about it. The Air Force's idea was that they didn't need all these big forces, you just nuke them with the dirty bomb.
Did they actually kind of come up? I mean, that was the point that you got from... okay, and that doesn't sound much like what you...
Not what I was doing.
...had in mind as a useful way of conducting U.S.
foreign policy.
Now,
and I'd argue with them. I was a distinguished graduate, and I don't really know how, because I would argue with them a lot.
And you played some golf, too, probably.
Well, some handball.
Handball. Okay.
I have time to play golf.
You're not a golfer?
No.
Okay. So would you find somebody of like mind to play handball with, or somebody that you could argue with?
Oh, somebody I could argue with. They were all very pleasant.
Okay. I suspect.
Had a lot of good Air Force friends in there.
Mm-hmm. How long did the course last?
About 10 months.
Now, did you have a final project of some kind?
No, just the paper that I wrote on Three Without Joy.
Okay. When you were moving on from this to your next assignment, do you remember how it came about?
Well, I don't know. I think I went to the chief of staff's office, and I think somebody up there requested me. Colonel Volney Warner was the executive officer to the chief of staff of the Army. He probably requested me.
Volney Warner,
V-O-L-N-E-Y.
Mm-hmm.
He ended up with 4 stars.
Yes, I remember that. He was the executive officer to the COS?
To the chief of staff,
uh-huh,
right.
Uh-huh. And did you know him before?
Oh, yeah. I had relieved him in desk ops as the Vietnam desk officer 2 years before, so he went over to the White House to be the executive to Comer, Mr. Comer.
Okay. And, of course, you knew Comer as well.
Yeah.
From the olden days.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Herb.
Well, that's it from the time I briefed him in Vietnam and from the time he set up the Cords organization.
Right. And so it's your thinking that Warner had something to do with...
Getting me in the chief of staff's office,
okay.
Right.
And what position did you hold there?
Well, they had what they called the Seven Dwarfs. There were seven of us in the... well, some branch there, that whenever papers came up signed by a general from down below, we would investigate it to make sure that it conformed with Army policy. There was something the chief of staff could sign that it was a well-done paper.
And the chief of staff was General Westmoreland, is that right?
Yeah, right.
So did you see him then on a regular basis?
Oh, yeah. We were what was called the coordination division. That was it. And we coordinated all these papers, and then we would write what he should do with it. He should sign it, or he should send it back, or whatever.
Now, are we talking about 72 at this point, 1972?
71, 72, yeah,
1972. Give me, Herb, your appraisal of General Westmoreland at this point in his career.
Well, he was very good as a chief of staff. He depended on his staff a great deal.
Mm-hmm.
And he would say, should I sign this, Herb? And I'd say, yeah, should have signed this a long time ago. It was strictly Army stuff.
Mm-hmm.
We were going through the beginning of the volunteer Army at the time,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of issues were coming up before him. It was the coordination division. That's what it was. Coordination division of the Secretary of the General Staff.
Mm-hmm.
And we found it rather difficult to when a paper came up that we didn't like or that didn't exceed to other papers, we'd have a hard time sending it back. We had to be very subtle because some general had approved it.
Sure. So this was a little touchy, some of
them.
Yeah,
some of them were.
Uh-huh.
And so we'd have to go back to the officer that wrote it and say, hey, you're going to get your boss in trouble with this. And there were very few like that.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them were easy to approve.
You mentioned that it was the really looking toward the beginning of the volunteer Army at this point.
Yeah.
And I wonder what other were the principal issues coming to the chief of staff. Was there much Vietnam business at this point?
No, very little.
Really?
Vietnam had already been solved by the president. He had begun to withdraw.
Yes, and during 1972... also, the president opened discussions with People's Republic of China.
That's right.
And that sort of changed the context.
Yeah. So we didn't get involved in that in the coordination division.
The year before, I think, if I'm not mistaken, the Pentagon Papers, so-called, had been published.
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
No, I sure do.
What can you tell me about your reaction or the reaction of
others? Well, you see, I wrote the last two chapters when I was in ISA. And the Democrats lost the election.
Mm-hmm.
Les Skelp came to me and said, okay, we've written the Pentagon Papers. It wasn't called that in those papers. And what we haven't done is written the last two chapters of the Tet Offensive. And so you take November and December off and you write it. So I wrote the last two chapters of the Pentagon Papers. And when the administration changed,
mm-hmm.
I had the only copy, all 49 volumes, in a file cabinet in my office. And I guess I'm the only one that's read the whole 49 issues at that time.
I think you might be right.
Yeah.
So it was 49 volumes.
Volumes. And
mm-hmm.
They finally, somebody higher than me decided they would make 20 copies, I guess, and send them out to the LBJ Library and to the RAND Corporation and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had them, and I gave them to the Navy. They made the copies and sent them out. And so when they were published, I had a very long discussion with the FBI, who was trying to find out who knew about them.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew about them. Mm-hmm. And then when they came out, my friend Ernie May from Harper, I had nothing left to do for my PhD except a dissertation.
Mm-hmm.
And Ernie May at the American Historical Association criticized the Pentagon Papers as history. He said they were all done with documents, and a lot of the documents weren't very important, and they never interviewed the people and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And he said there was one volume that was far superior to the others in the use of the authors, in the author's use of the documents, and that was mine.
He said this publicly.
Yeah, at the American Historical Association. He didn't know who wrote it, of course.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
I did.
But he had picked it out by
yeah.
its quality. Uh-huh.
Yeah. And so I wrote him and said I only got a dissertation to do, and would this meet Harvard standards if I did all the things you said were wrong? And he said, yes, it would. Hurry up. Other people would be writing on it. And so I had a friend, a former student of mine, Major Paul Miles, in General Westmoreland's office. And General Westmoreland, Paul Miles had been a student of mine at West Point. So I talked to Paul Miles. He was General Westmoreland's historian, sort of.
Mm-hmm.
He ended up as the deputy director of the Department of History at West Point. But he was General Westmoreland's historian. Anytime anybody talked to General Westmoreland about the war, Paul Miles would keep him straight. And he knew all about it. And so I talked to him and said, look, I've got this opportunity to write my dissertation. And he said, well, put in for 6 months leave of absence from the Army. And I said, well, can you do that? Is that ever done? He said, don't worry about it. And he took my application into General Westmoreland and said, look, your part in this period of history has been misunderstood. Why don't you give Chandler access to your papers and he can straighten them out for your book when you write it, and give him 6 months off to do his dissertation.
Mm-hmm.
So I got 6 months off.
So Westmoreland said, yeah, that sounds like a good idea.
Yeah.
So what papers did you actually have access to?
Well, all of his back channels.
Meaning
the correspondence between him and General Wheeler and the president.
And Herb, where those papers are now?
Well, probably with Westmoreland's collection.
With his personal papers?
Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. And so I had 6 months off, and I wrote my dissertation.
And we might as well, I think, include in the record that Princeton University Press picked it up.
Oh, yeah.
And published it in 77, is that right?
77, yeah. I got my PhD in 74,
mm-hmm.
and they published it in 77. It was called The Unmaking of a President, Lyndon Johnson and Vietnam.
And it's emerged as a standard work in the field now.
Yeah,
because
I was right there in the middle of it.
Yeah, yes, sir.
And I interviewed all the people, Clark Clifford, Maxwell Taylor, Fowler. I was just going over some of it with Fowler, who was Secretary of the Treasury.
Now, did you do these interviews during that six-month period?
Oh, yeah, during the six-month period. Walt Rostow interviewed him down in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
Dean Rusk interviewed him down in Georgia. So, yeah, I did all of it.
I think in the introduction, too, you mentioned, although in a different capacity, Secretary Rusk.
Oh, yeah.
And did you meet with him at all, Herb?
In Georgia, yes.
Okay. And that's when he was at the University of Georgia?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you interviewed him there?
Oh, yeah.
What kind of impression did he make on you?
Well, the impression I got, it's very interesting because the day that I sat down to interview him when we were sitting in his office, he got the word that the President Johnson had just died.
Oh, is that right?
And the impression I got from him was that he was very loyal and was willing to continue on if the President said so.
Mm-hmm. But he had become quite loyal to LBJ.
Yeah. Huh. And everybody was, actually, but mm-hmm. They had different points of view. His point of view was we should continue on the war and negotiate.
Right, right. And it's interesting the distinction that you draw between being loyal to someone and disagreeing with them.
Yeah.
I mean, it's possible to do both.
Yeah, exactly.
Did you at any point meet with Philip Habib?
No, never did.
Never did? Okay.
I think he was gone by that time.
That's probably, well,
in the Middle East. Somewhere.
Yeah, off in the Middle East. Yeah, he had other fish to fry by that point. Well, let me go back to your return to the Army after being awarded the doctorate degree. What happened on your return?
Well, I didn't have a home anymore. The coordination division, they had a guy in charge, and he said, well, you've been gone and you don't know what's going on, so I had to find a home.
Mm-hmm.
And I was assigned to the National War College for about 6 months, and then I came to the Joint Staff, and because of my great background in Vietnam, they put me in the NATO policy branch.
And where was that? Where was the office?
In the Joint Staff.
Okay.
Joint Chiefs of Staff.
And how long were you there?
About a year, and then I retired from the Army from there.
Tell me about the work at the NATO policy unit.
Well, we have to go to NATO once every 3 months or so, and we were doing a comparison of the Russians and the NATO staff, see who was ahead. It was pretty interesting. And we got the, specialization, rationalization was coming about at that time, and we had to say what we were prepared to do. I had the DPQ, the Defense Policy Questionnaire, which gave the U.S. What things in Europe were supposed to be NATO and which were not NATO.
Mm-hmm.
And that's about it. It was interesting.
Now, your decision to retire, was that driven by personal motives, or had you kind of run out of places to go in the Army and wanted to try something else? Or?
Well, yeah, personal.
Uh-huh.
I wanted to go somewhere else, really.
Okay.
I had done all I could do on Vietnam, and there wasn't any place else to go. Sure, I'd done Special Forces.
You sure had. Yeah. You had done quite a lot, sir.
Yeah.
Herb, let me ask you, as you left the Army in 1975, right, when you retired,
right.
How, in your view, had the Vietnam experience changed the Army?
Well, we were now going to a volunteer army. That was one thing. That was a ploy that Nixon used to lower casualties and lower the draft calls and so on.
Right.
So it changed in that way that we had a volunteer army. As far as the officers were concerned, a lot of good officers have gotten out because of that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I really hadn't been with the Army after my second tour in Vietnam. I came back to the Chief of Staff's office, and he was very cool toward the volunteer army. He was told to do it, so he did it.
Yes.
But he didn't like it very much. Mm-hmm. Didn't think it would work. He had one guy on the staff who was in charge of things like that, and he would ask us for things to do and things that we thought were useful.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. I really never got back to the Army.
Go ahead, Herb.
I was in the Pentagon.
Yes, that's right. Were you thinking of yourself at this point more as a scholar than as a Army commander?
Well, both, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't come up on the brigade command list. They have a group that selects people to be brigade commanders, and I didn't make that list, so apparently my options in future were limited. So I decided to get out then when I got my PhD and pursue scholarly things. Yeah, I guess so.
And you did it with some success, too. I will just say you went to the Industrial College of the Armed Forces.
Well, first I went to the Library of Congress.
How long were you there? That's right, the Congressional Research Service?
Congressional Research Service. Uh-huh. They were trying to build a military branch. They had the Foreign Affairs Division, and they made it the Foreign Affairs and National Defense Division because there wasn't anything to do in foreign affairs, really.
Uh-huh.
The Foreign Affairs Committees didn't have a great deal of responsibility.
And what did they give you to do?
Oh, I would ask things about why don't we have a home port in Haifa, and I would have to investigate that. I'd have how do we sell ships to foreign countries? Are there U.S. men of war? Do you have to report to Congress? Arms sales, I got involved in arms sales a great deal.
Mm-hmm.
And that led me to the President Jimmy Carter had a PD-14, he put limitations on arms sales. U.S. embassies couldn't push it and couldn't help people. We couldn't develop weapons specifically for sale to other countries and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And anything over $25 million of major defense equipment had to be done through the government. And that really made people mad, manufacturers mad, because they could do it so much more efficiently, they felt, than the government.
Mm-hmm.
And so after 4 years to the Library of Congress, I joined the SLABI, the American League for International Security Assistance, which had been formed by these people, 40 companies and 4 international unions.
Mm-hmm.
And we worked with them.
And then what was the mission of the
To remove the restrictions on arms sales.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And basically we removed them. Actually, when Reagan came into the presidency, and he was appointing Al Haig as Secretary of State,
mm-hmm.
and Al Haig's assistant or deputy or personal assistant was Woody Goldberg, who had been a student of mine at West Point. And Woody had been Al Haig's headquarters company commander in Vietnam when he had a brigade.
Mm-hmm.
And so Woody called me up and said, Al Haig's looking for some things to read while he's waiting confirmation. Do you have anything? And I sent him all our precision papers. And as soon as Reagan got in, Woody asked us who we wanted to talk to, and we told him, and we talked to him, and they removed some of the restrictions, and we won.
Wow.
And my boss, who was a member of Congress, a former member of Congress, went off to play golf in Arizona and said, good luck to the rest of you. So we did the worst thing you can do as a Washington lobbyist. We basically solved the problem.
Right.
And then I went to ICAF.
Got yourself out of a job.
Yeah, okay. Exactly. And then I went to ICAF.
Now, tell me about being at ICAF.
Well, I taught for a while in the political science department.
Mm-hmm.
And then I became the director of the strategy department, which was all the whole first semester. And we had in there, we had history and political science and leadership and economics and what was it? Oh, and war fighting. And I held that position for 6 years and sort of got the school organized, got the curriculum over. Authorized,
mm-hmm.
and then spent the next 5 or 6 years building up a history department, and then I became just a professor, and I taught, and that was a lot of fun, because these guys were, and girls, were lieutenant colonels, most of them on the road, a colonel and general, who were very interested. And like most schools, you had a lot of competition.
Mm-hmm.
You had a lot of smart people.
Yeah, this would, I mean, be an ideal teaching
situation,
I would think.
Exactly.
Everyone's motivated. Everybody wants to be there.
Yeah, everybody's mature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And everybody's serious.
And were you primarily focusing on teaching Vietnam lessons?
Oh, no. I gave one lecture on Vietnam, and I had an elective on Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And but most of the time I was teaching political science for 13 years and history for about 7.
And American history or
History of the world.
Oh, okay. Really?
We called it historic case studies in grand strategy.
Wow.
We would skip around.
Mm-hmm.
The wars, we didn't teach wars. We taught what led to the wars, what caused them.
Okay.
You know, we have a lesson on leading up to World War One and the period between the wars and what led up to World War Two, and then something on the Cold War, but not the wars in general. We talked about the diplomacy of leading up to the wars.
Okay, so the grander strategic issues.
Yeah, that's right.
Rather than operations.
In fact, they called it the strategy department,
mm-hmm.
but the official title was case studies in grand strategy.
And how many faculty members did you have in the department at the time you left? In 91, is that right?
10 or 12, yeah, I left. I retired at
No, after that.
I retired in 90. Retired in 2004.
And did ICAF remain? Did it change its name, or were there other?
No. The Eisenhowers said they would never change the name.
Okay.
It was given to them by the.
And actually, where is it located? Where is the?
Forming there, right next to the War College.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
The National Defense University mm-hmm. consists of the National War College, the ICAF, and the Joint Services Staff College in Norfolk.
Now, let me ask you a couple of big picture questions, Herb.
Yeah.
How much do you think the Vietnam War has influenced subsequent foreign policy making debates at the highest levels in the U.S. government?
Very much so. After Vietnam, for a long period of time, our policy was no more Vietnam's.
Mm-hmm.
And we wouldn't get involved. Secretary Weinberger, when he was Secretary of Defense, put out six principles that the United States would try. First of all, that the war was important to the United States. Secondly, that we would go for victory and things like that, which made it sort of impossible for us to go to war. And then we had the Persian Gulf War, the first one,
mm-hmm.
and we showed how good the Army was. And it was just for a period of time there, the use of military force to achieve public policy objectives was not acceptable. Congress in El Salvador put a limitation of 50 American advisors on,
mm-hmm.
and that was that. We just were not going to use military force. The Army was getting better and better because it was all volunteer and the officers knew what to do. But we weren't going to use it very much.
And so would you say that the thing that has changed between the period that you're talking about and currently our willingness and, in fact, seems national enthusiasm for using troops overseas.
Yeah, well, that's right. Yeah.
Is that because of 9/11?
I think it is, yes.
And can you talk about the impact that you see that having on us in the United States?
The impact it's having is it makes it much more difficult to maintain a volunteer army because people don't want to join when they can be killed.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think we're having a hard time maintaining the army over there now. When you had a draft, you could say, we need 50,000 more, and you get 50,000 more, whether they were motivated or competent or not.
Right.
And before that, we had very competent people. We had restrictions on enlistments. You couldn't enlist if you had smoked marijuana, if you hadn't graduated from high school, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a very good army. And now it's beginning to flatten out again.
Do you suspect that we're going to be moved, whether there's popular support for it or not, toward some kind of national service or?
Oh,
or
I don't think so. No.
No,
nobody in Congress wants that. But the Army may move to it.
Mm-hmm. The Army might like to have it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But your thinking is it may not get
their way. Yeah, but the Army's better when people are. Is the wannabe,
mm-hmm, sure.
Especially the combat arms branches.
Sure. Can you offer any observations on current situation in Iraq?
No, there ought to be some way of solving these, whatever they call them, IEBs, intermediate bombs or something.
Mm-hmm.
I think they can solve that pretty easily with the patrols up down the side of the convoys. And I don't know what they can do about the insurgents. I think we have to build up the Iraqi armed forces in order to handle them.
Sure.
It's not our problem.
Does it seem to you to have any is there any analytical value in the parallels that are being drawn between this conflict and the one in Vietnam?
Not very much, because in Vietnam it was a nationalist war. The North Vietnamese had always wanted the South. It was a civil war, basically, although they said they had no term for that.
Mm-hmm.
And, in fact, I'm working on a book now that says we could never have won that, because no matter how many people it took, they were going to fight for South Vietnam. It was part of their heritage.
Mm-hmm.
They'd been fighting for 2,000 years, and we knew nothing about that, and they weren't going to give up. And by 1965, the D.C. in the little hamlets and villages had already won that part of the war. So
the book that you're working on, can you tell me a little bit about it? Who's going to bring it out? Do you know? And
well, I think the Rutgers University Press.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I'm still talking to them.
Okay. But you're thinking in the next year or so?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
And it's going to be in time of the war that couldn't be won. And I don't think we could have ever won. We'd still be fighting. We were sort of stalemated at the time.
Mm-hmm. And you think we could still, I mean, if...
We'd still be fighting if we left anybody over there, and they'd still have our prisoners.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Well, Herb, is, first of all, I want to thank you for your time. You've invested quite a bit of time in this interview, and I appreciate it, as do my colleagues here at the Vietnam Archive. Let me just close by asking you if there's any additional observations that you would like to offer at this point that perhaps I haven't asked you about, or other contributions that you might like to put place on the record.
Well, we should always be careful when we get into these wars as to what's going to happen. The Vietnamese, we could never win, and we had an artificial government that was set up there, and it was not very efficient,
mm-hmm.
and we never should have gotten in there. And I think John Kennedy knew that. Unfortunately, he was executed, and Lyndon Johnson sent a lot of people over. There was no reason for us to get involved. The North Vietnamese, although they said they were communists, were not interested in going into Laos and Cambodia and the rest of they weren't interested in doing the Chinese bidding or the Soviet bidding.
Mm-hmm.
And so before we get into something like that, we ought to know. In Iraq, General Shinseki told them that we didn't have enough men there. And they said they didn't know what he was talking about. Well, he didn't know what he was talking about. We don't have enough men. And it'll take a long time to have peace over there when some people don't... it's an artificial country, really.
Yes, it's a colonially drawn country.
Yeah,
with
Sunnis and all others and Kurds. And
all the problems that come with that.
That's right.
And do you think that, like, we didn't have a good analytical sense of the political traditions and backgrounds in Vietnam.
Yeah.
Similarly, we don't have that for the Middle
East. That's right. We don't have that, and we didn't try. Mm-hmm. We're trying to get the Sunnis and the Shiites together, and they don't want to be together, and the Kurds are happy being separate, and
mm-hmm.
we have to form a civil government, and we're not very good at that.
And it's difficult to do that with troops occupying.
Yeah, and it's very difficult to do that with incompetent people who have never done that before.
Is it
not necessarily incompetent, but they're not used to it.
They're not experienced in this. Well, Herb, thank you for those observations and for all your time. And
well,
I appreciate your participation.
You're very welcome.